Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you were anywhere near a radio in the year 2000, you might have had a hard time avoiding David Gray's hit song, Babylon. Let go your heart, let go your hair, and fail it now. Let go your heart, let go your hair, and fail it now. Babylon. The British singer-songwriter is back with a new album, and it's one that has a bit of a different sound. Actually, to hear David Gray tell it, it has a bunch of different sounds, like this. Yeah, well, if you're wondering just what the heck that was, wait a few minutes, because you will hear David Gray making each of those noises in context. He'll join us to play some of his new songs and talk about the new record in just a couple of minutes. But first,
are you ready for some football?
Now, for those of you keeping track, we're just about 4 weeks away from opening day of the 2014 NFL season. But there's already plenty of buzz surrounding one team and one musician's interest in owning that team.
Shut up!
Jon Bon Jovi is a potential buyer of the Buffalo Bills football franchise, which is currently up for sale. But as it turns out, Bills fans are none too pleased about the prospect of their team being owned by the New Jersey Rocker. Joining me is Reeves Weideman, who recently covered this story for New York Magazine. Reeves, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So this isn't about Jon Bon Jovi being from New Jersey, or even about him being a very vocal Giants fan.
It's not. It's not some regional rivalry, really. Although Bills fans are quick to point out that their team is the only team actually in New York State. You mentioned he's a Giants fan. One thing that a lot of Bills fans point out is he was actually on the sidelines for the worst moment in Bills history, but he was on the Giants sideline in the Super Bowl when the Bills kicker missed a field goal wide right.
No good. Wide right.
And the Giants won the Super Bowl, and Bon Jovi was there celebrating with Phil Simms and the rest of the Giants. But the issue is also has nothing to do with Jon Bon Jovi's music.
Although there's a
tension
that we'll
of that, which we can get into a little bit later.
Yeah.
But the issue is that it's very expensive to buy a football team. It's going to cost a little over $1 billion, most likely. And he's teamed up. Bon Jovi has a lot of money, but he doesn't have that much money. He doesn't have a billion. And he's teamed up with a group of businessmen in Toronto, which is about a 90-minute drive north from Buffalo. He has a long-standing relationship with these guys. I went through and counted since 2000. He's played the Air Canada Centre 19 times.
In Toronto.
Yeah, that's the arena in Toronto.
So Bills fans are putting two and two together and getting
a
billion.
It's sort of like, I mean,
a billion reasons for Jon Bon Jovi to move the team
to Buffalo. Yeah,
to Toronto.
The guys in Bon Jovi wants a football team. The guys in Toronto seem to want a team in Toronto. Bon Jovi seems willing to go along with that. They have not said that's what they're doing, but you can read between the lines that it seems pretty likely.
Reeves, in your article, you mentioned that, you know, owning an NFL franchise, first of all, it's so rare for a franchise to come up for sale. So $1 billion for a small market team that has never won the Super Bowl, you know, just gives you an idea of just how ferocious the competition must be. So who is Jon Bon Jovi up against here?
He's up against a couple of different people. They've been the most prominent group from elsewhere. The only other person who's really from outside of Buffalo, has no connection to Buffalo previously, is Donald Trump, who claims to be serious, but you never really know. And then there are the other two candidates that people are really leaning on are two local billionaires, much less sexy names than John Bon Jovi. One of them was in natural gas and made several billion dollars. Another built a payroll system. And so they're both from Buffalo or near Buffalo. One of them is the owner of the Buffalo Sabres. And they are more or less the people, particularly that guy, Terry Pegula, who's the owner of the Sabres. People are hoping he's going to be the one to buy the team. And he seems to be very seriously bidding, but has been very quiet. And the other thing is that the team is going to be much more valuable in Toronto. And so there's fear and speculation that the Toronto team will be willing to bid more, and that the Buffalo bidders just won't keep up.
So Bon Jovi himself has been very quiet about all of this.
He has.
Until this weekend, when he offered to the Buffalo News a kind of open letter to the fans. And I want to read the kind of the salient quote here from John Bon Jovi. Our objective is simple, to carry on the legacy of Ralph Wilson and make the Bills successful in Buffalo. We are committed to working with the state, city, county, and business community to identify the best possible site in the Buffalo area for a new stadium and to then develop and implement a plan to finance and build a state-of-the-art NFL stadium for the loyal Bills fans. That sounds pretty convincing.
It sounds pretty convincing, but the one thing he didn't say there is a very simple sentence, or maybe two sentences. We are not interested in moving the team to Toronto. We will keep them in Buffalo. It's very much, we will explore every option available. We'll do everything we can to try to keep the team there. But if it's worth an extra $200 or $300 million and my business partners want it in Toronto, there may be nothing I can do. So
when he says the best possible site in the Buffalo area, does Toronto, despite being across an international border, does that qualify as the Buffalo area?
I think if we're looking at this getting into the legalese, I think he could get away with it there. It's funny, there are a lot of Toronto, something like 20% of the season ticket holders among Bills fans are Canadians, and some of them drive all the way from Toronto.
Hasn't Buffalo played a home game every year Toronto?
For the past several years, they've been playing home games there. They're not this year, and in part because the experiment doesn't really seem to have taken off.
Okay.
And this is, again, from the Bills fans' perspective, one thing in Ontario, there's a law basically prohibiting tailgating, which
right.
is like, you know, half of the, if not 90% of the NFL experience. So the games have been pretty stale. There's not, and a lot of people will say Toronto's more a white-collar town, Buffalo's a blue-collar town, so the environment doesn't seem to quite be there yet.
We're speaking with Reeves Weideman, who is a member of the editorial staff for The New Yorker, although he wrote this piece for New York Magazine about the Buffalo Bills and New Jersey rocker John Bon Jovi, who is part of this consortium trying to buy the team. Bills fans are very upset with the idea that they might move the team to Toronto, and despite this weekend's letter from John Bon Jovi, Bills fans are buying, they're not buying into this, they're having none of it. And although, Reeves, you said before, it's not that they don't like his music has now been caught in the crossfire here.
It has, and so basically the main form this protest has taken is Bon Jovi's music is not welcome in Buffalo in many ways. There are several radio stations. The 80s rock station in Buffalo has called for a Bon Jovi-free summer. They rewrote the lyrics of Living on a Prayer and have been playing that.
Johnny used to get played on Jack. Now he wants our Bills, but Buffalo just won't take that. He's whack.
Cover bands have stopped playing him. There's YouTube videos of a cover band trying to play Living on a Prayer at a festival in Buffalo and getting booed, not quite off the stage, but enough to make it an uncomfortable experience. There are posters around town, and so in general, people are not interested in hearing any of his songs anymore.
So even in the classic rock arena there in Buffalo, you're not getting any Bon Jovi right
it's
now.
It's funny. I mean,
it's going to be like half their playlist.
I will. Well, I will. Say, the radio station said they had 13 songs that they had to take out of rotation. I will say, there weren't too many people who seemed to think this was a huge sacrifice in their lives. A lot of people in Buffalo denied being glam rock fans, if we're going to put Bon Jovi in that genre. There were a lot more Metallica fans. One guy told me that if the members of the Grateful Dead, who are still with us, decided to move the team to Berkeley or wherever, he might cut his concert intake from 20 Grateful Dead concerts to 10 a year.
Uh-huh.
I got a lot more of, if Van Halen came through or Pearl Jam.
You must have found some loyal Bon Jovi fans there in Buffalo.
I did. Well, they were thankfully easy to find because, as I mentioned, Bon Jovi had been to Toronto 19 times in the past 10 or 15 years. He'd been to Buffalo only 3 times. And so I did want to make sure that I found some Bon Jovi fans in Buffalo, and there were a number of online groups starting petitions trying to get him to come back, and I found, I think, the biggest fan. Biggest Bon Jovi fan in Buffalo. She was a hairstylist, of course, perfectly. She has a salon just outside of Buffalo covered with Bon Jovi pictures.
Mm-hmm.
She said no one had come in requesting the Bon Jovi, so to speak. But she was a huge fan, and she...
What's her name?
Her name, it's complicated. Her given name is Jamie Lynn Richter.
But
when she handed me her business card, it said Jovi Lynn
that's
Richter.
That's a big fan.
And she said I could simply call her Jovi. So there are still and she's a Bills fan, but she at least believes that I think so strongly in her man that he wouldn't possibly tear the team away and do that to her. So
all right, so John Bon Jovi. He's worth about $300 million.
That's what Forbes says, yeah.
But to buy an NFL team, even the Buffalo Bills, mm-hmm. you know, $1 billion, maybe even a little more.
Small market, the third least valuable team in the NFL is still worth $1 billion.
And it has to be in cash.
More or less, yeah. You have to, you're not going to be able to take out loans on this. And,
right.
and that's why it's extremely elite in terms of the number of people who can buy these teams and to become a principal owner, which it seems likely that Bon Jovi would like to be, you have to have somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million, the third of the sale price.
So this is not Jay-Z buying a fraction of 1% of the Brooklyn Nets so that he can say he's a part owner of a professional team. This is a guy who's all in.
It seems like it. I mean, it's hard to say. For Jay-Z, it became very clear that was more of a boosting the Jay-Z brand. John Bon Jovi wants a seat at the table among the NFL owners. He's a diehard football fan, and this is what he wants. So no one knows exactly how their deal will work out, but it seems likely that that's what he's going for.
Now, we knew he was a Giants fan, mm-hmm. but he has some sports ownership experience, right?
He does. He maybe 5 or 6 years ago, was a founding owner of the Philadelphia Soul, which is an Arena League football team in Philadelphia. A very successful team. He's always frequent to point out. And he's tried in the past to buy other NFL teams. He tried to buy a stake in the Atlanta Falcons in 2011. So it's clear that for him, the interest is less in the Buffalo Bills specifically and just buying a team of any kind.
Important to say that, you know, because they are so rare that you get a chance to bid on a franchise for an NFL team, they are like guaranteed money. I mean,
totally. I mean, and even in, you know, a lot of people have been saying, you know, the team will be worth so much more in Toronto. The team is worth a lot in Buffalo, and NFL finances all the companies are, or all the teams are private, rather. Companies was probably a fitting slip of the tongue there, but they're all private, so we don't really get to see the finances. But we have seen there have been leaked documents. The Carolina Panthers, another, you know, medium sized mm-hmm, market. Mm-hmm. Their owner made over $100 million in 2 years. So this is a big business for, you know, it's not a loss leader for Bon Jovi.
He's apparently cut the price of his penthouse apartment that he's selling and cast loose a longtime member of the band. People are viewing all of this now as, you know, I gotta get my cash together because we're serious about buying this team.
Yeah, it's been and it was funny talking to Bills fans who were becoming very familiar with the business dealings of various billionaires, and in Bon Jovi's case, there was this was about almost a year ago now, so this has been long standing that he cut well, depends on who you talk to, but Richie Sambora, his longtime guitarist, sort of the Steven Van Zandt to his Bruce Springsteen. Left the tour last year, and CBS Sports had a report citing music industry sources saying that he was cut because he was so expensive, and Bon Jovi was trying to build up some cash reserves.
All right, so Reeves, where do we go from here? How long is this process likely to take? Will Bon Jovi's music be back on the air in Buffalo at some point down the road?
I think that question remains to be seen. The process is any day an owner could be announced. It would probably be in the next several weeks or months. There's an owners' meeting of all the NFL owners in October, and the speculation, at least, is that the family, Ralph Wilson's family, which is selling the team, would like to have an owner by then to then get approval from the other NFL owners. The 24 of the 32 NFL owners would have to say, yes, we're okay with John Bon Jovi being at least part owner of one of our teams. And then, you know, I'd like to think that the Buffalo will be forgiving as long as...
As they have a team.
if John Bon Jovi buys the team and they eventually move to Toronto, it's worth noting that the team will be there regardless for the next several years because of their lease agreement. But if down the road that the team gets moved, I would find it hard to imagine that he will be on the air very much going forward.
Reeves Weideman is a member of the editorial staff at The New Yorker. You can find a link to his recent article for New York Magazine about the Buffalo Bills and Jersey rocker John Bon Jovi at soundcheck.org. Reeves, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'll chat with singer-songwriter David Gray about two important topics. First, the producer who shaped the sound of his new album. And second, we'll talk about bird watching. Oh, and he'll play live in the studio, too. David Gray, next on Soundcheck.
I'm Allison from Bellbrook, Ohio, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In 1998, the British singer and songwriter David Gray was beaming into virtually every pair of speakers in the country. His song Babylon was inescapable, and it kickstarted a long series of records and tours that cemented his status as one of the great confessional songwriters of the last two decades. Big as it was, Babylon is now just a small piece of Gray's 20-plus year career. His latest album is called Mutineers, and David Gray joins us here in the Soundcheck studio at Our Piano to play a couple of songs from it. Starting with this one, called Back in the World, it's David Gray, live on Soundcheck.
Every day when I open my eyes, now it feels like a Saturday, yeah. Taking down from the shelf all the parts of myself that I packed away, yeah. If it's love lifts us up from the dark, is it God by another name? I know is I'm back in the world again. Like the lift of a curse, got a whole different person inside my head. Now I'm trudging around stony-eyed through the town like the living did. Now, if it's love puts the joy in my heart, is it God by another name? Who's to say how it goes? All I know is I'm back in the world again. Back in the world again. It's the only way to be. The only way to be. I'm naked like a tree. It's the only way to be. I'm naked like a tree. Less than sand on the beach, staring into the reaches of space and time. I'm singing out words with the voice that I hear. It seems barely mine, yeah. If it's love puts the song in my heart, is it God by another name? Who's to say how it goes? All I know is I'm back in the world again. To say how it goes, all I know is I'm back in the world again. Back in the world again. It's the only way to be. The only way to be. I'm naked like a tree. I'm naked like a tree. It's the only way to be. It's the only way to be. The only way to be. The only way to be. It's the only way to be. Every day when I open my eyes. Every day when I open my eyes, yeah, yeah. Every day when I open my eyes, yeah, yeah. Every day when I open my eyes, yeah, yeah.
That's David Gray, live at our piano here in the Soundcheck studio, and a solo version of his song, Back in the World. David Gray, back in the saddle after, what, 4 years between albums?
Yeah, I guess I took a little bit of a break there, although it probably wasn't that much of a break. I think I was restless to do something new, and this record took a bit of getting together. I didn't want to make the same record again in the same way again. So I had a few false starts and wrote an awful lot of material, just searching for a way out of the sort of cul-de-sac that I seemed to be finding myself in. So, yeah, it seems like a long time, but it was a busy time, too.
Yeah. How far down the road do you have to go before you realize that something is a false start and you need to kind of back up and do it again?
Well, I guess in both instances, I spent... Well, the first time a few weeks, the second time a couple of months, just giving it everything I had, trying to make something happen in the studio. Mm. I think at the back of my mind, on both occasions, I already suspected that what I needed was somebody else, someone to unlock the music in a new way. Jestin Paulsen, who's the guy I've made an awful lot of records with down the years from White Ladder onwards, I think we just basically just run out of new places to go. Mm. But we tried again under completely different circumstances. We sort of twisted everything around and sort of self-consciously created a different recording atmosphere and environment and tried to do it differently. It just didn't work. It was too much of a stretch. So I think all the time during both sessions, I was sort of noticing that I think I needed someone to unlock a new world of sound. So it was finding that person.
Someone to give you a quick kick in the seat of the pants, huh?
Yeah, well, that was a part of it, I suppose. I guess you're inviting them in to threaten your world.
Yeah,
it's like to take what you know and how you do it and tell you that you should try doing it in a different way.
And for you, that was Andy Barlow from the band Lamb.
That's right, yeah.
So, I mean, they're kind of, on this side of the Atlantic at least, known, if at all, as a kind of a trip-hop band.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, did that seem like foreign soil to you? Did you
no,
feel?
No, I think I'm au fait with all kinds of music, electronic and rock, pop, folk, jazz. I mean, I don't mind. To be honest, I'm thirsty to get into the world of electronic sound.
Mm.
It fascinates me. And obviously, I come from completely the opposite discipline, which is songwriting on an acoustic guitar or on a piano. So it was exactly what I craved, new vistas. So I would have seen that as a positive and in no way a possible obstacle. It was more whether we could get on as people in a creative sense and otherwise in the studio. That was the challenge. I think in that way, perhaps British music's slightly different. You know, whereas you've got all the pop stuff mashed mm-hmm. together over there in a very different way than it is in the States, where it's more separate.
Yeah.
Roots music and rap music and everything all has its own sort of dimension. In the UK, it's a bit more thrown together, and there isn't such a rootsy base to everything. It's kind of more chaotic.
We're speaking with David Gray. His new album is called Mutineers, produced with Andy Barlow of Lamb. And the title, Mutineers, I mean, was there a kind of a mutiny in the studio unfolding?
There was a mutiny, definitely, yeah. I mean, I think I was both the captain of the ship and the mutinous crew on this record. I had to throw myself overboard in order to get where I needed to go. I sort of understood that at the beginning. That's why I like the title. I think it's simple and sort of punchy and ear-catching.
Yeah.
But it's also a key track on the record, which was very much made at Andy's behest. He sort of tore up an existing song until there was virtually nothing left apart from the one chord sequence that's used throughout the track. And I had to sort of start again looking for a melody, a lyric, a structure. And I thought it was an act of madness at the time, and I was highly vexed by it. But once it started to come together, we suddenly got ahead of steam, and then we spent like a day and a half just blitzing the track with different ideas, and suddenly it was there in front of me with all the vocals on and everything. We just needed to put the bass and drums on.
Drink the damn place dry, only plan of attack. And babe, sure feels good, sure feels good.
And I realized that he had an ear for these things, and it sort of built up the trust. Beautiful Agony was another key song exactly like that, where he didn't want to work on the things I'd already written and had ready. He took me off somewhere else to work on something that was half finished or not even that. And it just seemed like crazy, but it worked. So I think it allowed him into the track on like a level playing field.
The beginning, on the record, the beginning of Beautiful Agony has this odd sort of harmonic sequence. You know, it's not, they're not the notes as they would lie on the piano here, but there's a little electronic intro to the song.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what that is. It's two sounds mashed together. It's the whirly tubes that you get to make the woo.
Right, right. Which takes you up the harmonic sequence. Yeah,
so that's what you're hearing, moving the notes. And the other thing was a MIDI mistake where the whole system froze and we got like a sort of blanket chord going with like a lot of wrong notes in it. But I just said, oh, I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we kept that. And then we just threw my, I did have the whirly tubes on top. And that became the intro to the song.
So here in the studio, no upright piano, although you have our Steinway.
I'm not complaining.
But no whirly, no gated reverb, no MIDI mistakes. And yet it's the song is the, you at the piano at its heart.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And I think nearly everything on the record it goes along those lines. You know, it still comes down to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it's the way the sound was treated that suddenly refreshed that simple formula. If anything, the music was simplified, and one of his keywords was vanilla, which is his word for, like, basically simplify the bass line. Take the notes out, just no, man, that's too muso, he'd say. And the bass player would go, what? It's called melody. Yeah. But he took all the melody out.
I'm just thinking, you know, if someone's sitting at home with like a digital recorder running on this conversation, they now have a whole library of sampled sounds of David Gray making mouth noises.
Well, we use that a lot on the record as well. If we couldn't find the synth sound, I'd go in there and try and sing it. Right. And then we'd stick that through an effect, which I'd say to any recording artist is a great way to go. Do it yourself. A lot of the Queen sounds, I know this for a fact. Roger Taylor does a lot of the horn sounds and crazy sounds on things like, even like Bohemian Rhapsody. It was like, you know, it's a human being pretending to be a trumpet. It's a lot cheaper too.
All right, well, you wanna revisit our piano there and play this song for us? It's called Beautiful Agony. David Gray is my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. The album Mutineers is out now. Here's the song called Beautiful Agony, played live by David Gray.
Love vandalizing me,
painful agony.
Once again, David Gray, live at Our Piano here in the Soundcheck studio in a song called Beautiful Agony. The song appears on David Gray's most recent album called Mutineers, which is out now. You were talking before about, you know, how in America we tend to separate out all our different, you know, we got our roots music here, our rap music there, our rock music there, and it's all more mixed up. You listen to a lot of stuff growing up and coming at this from folk music. We were talking just before going on the air a little about music, and you mentioned two classical composers, Olivier Messiaen and the Englishman Gavin Bryars, both of whom have, like, at least some relationship to electronic music. But, you know, contemporary classical music, is that something that you're big fan of?
I'll listen to anything. I've got totally eclectic taste. I mean, the records, I guess, that have touched me the deepest are generally singer-songwriters over the past 30-odd years. But there's a whole massive swathe of other stuff from jazz records and other things, haunting classical records, that really get under my skin as well. And like, what I hear is the sounds and the different rules that seem to be a part of their construction, the other world that they live in. Mm. That's what's so intoxicating. It's like breathing another air, listening to music from a completely different perspective like that. So I think it fires the imagination. And of course, you know, pop music's been stretching out in lots of ways with bands like Talk Talk and all kinds of people who've moved, pushed the envelope out, bands like Radiohead, I suppose,
sure,
as well,
yeah,
who are curious to get other sounds and approaches involved. So, I guess I'm part of that as well. I just get itchy to touch some of this sort of celestial noise and to get out into these other spaces.
Well, the Frenchman, Olivier Messiaen, was a huge fan of birdsong, and there are several tracks on this new record that are bird-themed. It's certainly not the first time you've done that in your career.
There's a lot now.
So are you a birder?
I guess you could sort of say I am. Yeah, I wouldn't resist the tag.
You own binoculars which you observe birds?
Yeah, I do. But it's a relatively recent purchase. So I'd say that that's only the last 4 or 5 years that I've had a pair of binoculars. But it's been life-changing getting them. So I've just always been fascinated and enchanted by wildlife. And birds are obviously a very visible part of that. If you could see mammals wandering around all the time, I'd be just as keen to look at them. But there is something other about birds and their flying and singing. So they cast a spell over me, which is deepening the closer I get to them. And I think the binoculars have brought me into their world in a way that I couldn't have imagined before. And there's just more and more there. And so yes, it's a part of my life. It's a way I find of switching off. When I'm looking at birds, I'm an accidental bird watcher. I'm not a proper bird. I never go anywhere to see a bird. It's just what crosses my path. Mm-hmm. So I'm a rank amateur as well. I can't differentiate between, you know, vast swathes of bird life.
Well, let's remember what the word amateur literally means. Someone who does it for the love of it.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm still very much in that category. I can't get into it. It's like train spotting. The real bird watching. These people have sort of lost the plot, I think. It's like it's rarities.
Now, do people still do train? Is train spotting still a thing?
I think it's coming back, a bit like vinyl.
Really? So train spotting is becoming cool, is what you're saying.
Well, it's the age of the nerd. That's what we live in, isn't it? It's just an analog nerd rather than sort of one with a pencil rather than an iPhone.
Well, now, speaking of birds, I mean, there are many artists who have had, like, you know, hit first albums. And speaking of, you know, bird imagery and stuff, where that first album becomes like an albatross around the artist's neck.
Yeah.
Now, for you, with White Ladder, you know, with the big hits coming off that album, how has your relationship with that changed over the intervening years?
Well, it's...
If at all.
Well, of course, it's changed profoundly, and I think that it was a struggle for a while coming to terms with what that means, you know, the fact that, you know, you've got these big hits and you're sort of tied to them to a certain extent. So my project is always to expand what the audience might expect in a concert. If you gratify everybody by just playing exactly what they want when they want it, then that's what you're trapped within. So mm-hmm. every record I make, I will largely feature that when I go out and play, and I will use some of the other songs from White Ladder or otherwise things like The One I Love, big hit singles. I'll distribute those throughout to add a bit of punch here and there. But depending on the gig, sometimes I'll play acoustic shows and I won't honour those songs at all. I'll go completely out on a limb. That's how I sort of gain my sense of freedom and space, by changing all the time. But in the immediate aftermath of White Ladder, it was very powerful, the feeling that that was over me. Mm-hmm. You know, and the idea that perhaps I might want to escape it in some way. I think that's very common to artists who've experienced a similar thing. Well, I see it in other artists, people sort of resisting this thing and trying to prove a point otherwise. But I think defining...
Peter Frampton said almost exactly what you just said when he was here talking about Frampton Comes Alive on its 30th anniversary, that sense of it's this shadow that you've created that's now hanging over you.
Yeah, I mean, in a beautiful way, it's something mm-hmm. that's connected on a vast scale and has a power still, a power over you, I suppose. So it's just defining yourself and what you do in sort of negative terms. I'm not just that. Mm-hmm. I guess I've been through all that, and that never sat well with me, but I was restless underneath this weight. But suddenly the intensity of making this record and the music leading up to it, I mean, I wrote a lot of songs going into it, and what I put myself through, the act of surrender that was needed to find something new and to break open my processes and make myself wide open to somebody else coming in with a sort of wrecking ball, something about that and the shining light that we managed to discover in the music, my sense of returning to the source of what I do and how it's been strengthened by this. I came out the other side and I suddenly felt like the past had fallen into a perspective that it had never had before. And I don't feel like I'm resisting it in any way. I think it's just there now. And I feel very, very in the moment with the music I'm making. And I think that that's the most important thing. So the audience just have to go with me, you know. I will play big songs from the past, but I have to do what I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm. I'm perfectly happy to hear Babylon again, but I would so much love to hear you with a live performance of Gulls, the killer last track on this new record.
Thank you. Yeah.
It's an extraordinary song. The album's called Mutineers from David Gray. It is out now. David, it has been great having you here with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you very much.
This land belongs to the ghost.
Up next, how the battle between the Metropolitan Opera and its unions will affect opera lovers. We'll talk with Fred Plotkin of WQXR's blog Operavore next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The wedding has been on the calendar for months, but fighting within the family threatens to call the whole thing off. September 22nd is supposed to be opening night at the Metropolitan Opera, starting with Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. But a long and contentious fight between Met's management and its unions has dragged on through most of the summer and probably won't end. Yes, I'm going to go there. Probably won't end until the fat lady sings. Fred Plotkin is the man that we turn to whenever we need someone to make sense of the opera world for us, and he's here in the Soundcheck studio. Hi, Fred.
Hello, John.
So the New York Times called this the Met's most serious labor crisis in more than three decades. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think it may be the worst labor crisis ever at the Met.
Wow. What is causing this?
Well, I think maybe we should rephrase this and not call it labor crisis, but financial crisis. And I should point out first by saying that I am neither on management side nor the union side, but frankly on the side of the public and people love opera. So I'm speaking for your listeners and for myself. I think the problem is that for the past 7 years, the Met has been very badly managed financially. I don't much get into questions of artistic choice because I think if we looked back through the decades, we've forgotten a lot of awful productions that were done in the Bing and Bliss and Volpe and Crawford eras, and we just remember the good ones. And there were excellent productions in the Peter Gelb era as well.
Peter Gelb is the current.
The current general manager. But my concern is that if you don't run the place well financially, if you don't act smart in making your choices, then you won't have a Metropolitan Opera. And there have been a lot of situations in which there has not been smart decision-making.
Well, now, we saw what happened in the New York City Opera when it was mismanaged financially. There is no more New York City Opera after a long, illustrious history. Now, according to the Met, they say the problem is that they're running a $3 million deficit. The union counters by saying, well, that's on a $320 million budget, so that's not even 1%. It's not that bad. Where is the fiscal problem here?
The fiscal problem, I believe, comes from the fact that the Met has dipped deeply into its endowment. And there's a rule of thumb in arts management that your endowment must be at least equal to 1 year's budget. Mm-hmm. And the endowment has dropped down. We can approximate about $230 million. And the budget is approximately $330 million. So therefore, we're $100 million in the hole. How does this happen? I think the concern that Met management raises, or let's say Peter Gelb, is that labor costs are too expensive. But these existed in contracts. So a good manager knows that if this is what I have to pay, then you plan accordingly. And part of that is planning opera productions that require fewer rehearsals. Do fewer new opera productions if it's very expensive to rehearse them. I don't care a bit about the $137,000 spent on poppies for Prince Igor. That's a technicality the unions are harping on. The real problem is that if you are programming long operas and often together and have multiple rehearsals and the chorus and orchestra go into overtime, that gets expensive. Do fewer Meistersingers and Les Troyens, do them, but fewer, and do more Zalames and short operas that don't go into overtime, which is after 4 hours.
Although it's hard to think that as the general manager of the finest opera house, arguably in the Western Hemisphere, that you have to program according to when you're going to go into overtime or not.
Anyone does in any opera company. That's how you stay strong. And if they're not strong financially, they can't be strong artistically.
All right, we're speaking with Fred Plotkin, who blogs regularly at WQXR's OperaVore blog. You can find it on the website at WQXR.org. Surprise twist this weekend, Fred. There was a lockout looming, but it was averted this past weekend with the agreement to have an outside consultant come in and actually look at the finances.
Well, his name is, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Eugene Keilan or Keelan, and he's originally from Lazard Frere, and he is very competent. I'm not questioning him at all. But I think that any person who looks at the books of an opera company has to understand how money has to be spent at an opera company. It's not just a question of contracts that exist. I do believe, by the way, that there are reforms to be made in the agreements so that the unions, the workers, can be more giving in certain ways. But I always want to point out it is not their fault that they have the contracts they have. They were given those contracts. I think it's a very good thing, but it came way too late.
Yeah.
We keep talking about a lockout being averted. I think that Peter Gelb avoided a lot of earlier negotiation, a lot of planning and discussing when things were quieter. It meant that both sides, management and unions, have been playing this out in social media and in the public, and that's bad for the Met. And here I am as a member of the public, an opera lover.
Well, but now let me ask you. I mean, it is an ugly battle. It is playing out in public, in the press. Both sides are using the press as much as they possibly can.
Yes.
But in a funny sort of way, isn't this raising the profile of the Metropolitan Opera among people who might not be regular opera goers? It's sort of like thrusting it in our faces, saying, hey, you know, there's this story unfolding and you may have opera to watch this fall.
There are a lot of things I don't want in my face, and they may not have opera this fall. And that's really the problem. I'm very serious about this. When the fact that they did not try to take care of this months ago and crashed up against this deadline when the Met is supposed to open its season in 7 weeks, I have heard from many opera tour operators and independent people who come to New York for their week of opera every year, can I come, should I come? It affects restaurants, it affects hotels. I'm a New Yorker. It affects New York City's image. I was just in Europe, and people keep saying, how could this be? This is the Met. This is New York. This is America. You're supposed to be doing these things better, and it's embarrassing. And I am hard put to defend it. And again, I'm not taking sides here. Both sides. It's a problem.
All right. Now, but Fred, you were in the past, at some point in your past, production manager at
Performance manager.
Yeah. What is the drop-dead point beyond which you can't get a performance, you know, ready to go? When do they need to actually get this done?
If the employees are locked out, they can't rehearse. And by the way, when they're locked out, it means they don't have health insurance. Mm-hmm. And before I get to your question, I want to point out one more thing. Several members of the company retired July 31st, not wanting to, but just so they would have something to look forward to in terms of income. This is the Met eating its young and not so young. It's a loss of collective memory. And for the institution to be strong, it needs people who know how things work and how things worked in the past. But it takes, for a new production, 6 weeks at least of rehearsal. You need the artist here. You have to pay them. You have to have the stagehands working the scenery and making sure everything is safe.
Okay, so it takes 6 weeks to get a production ready. A new production. We're 7 weeks away from La Nozze di Figaro, The Marriage of Figaro. Is that a new production, or is that one that they can pull together on a couple of weeks' notice?
It's a new production.
Oh,
and forgive me, John, this is going to be a shotgun wedding.
If there's any wedding at all, that remains to be seen. All right, the negotiations, long and contentious, will be ongoing. Fred Plotkin will be following it, I'm sure, and you can follow Fred at the OperaVore blog at WQXR.org. Fred, always a pleasure to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
We're going to leave you with more music from David Gray's performance here in the Soundcheck studio. This is an older song. It originally appeared on David's 1998 album, White Ladder. It's called This Year's Love. It's David Gray on Soundcheck.
Like
circles and time again, cut like a knife. Find out if you love me, got to know for sure. 'Cause it takes something more this time than sweet, sweet lies. Find out before I open up my arms in fall, losing all control. Every dream inside my soul, won't you kiss me on that midnight street? Sweep me off my feet, singing, ain't this life so sweet? This year's love, it better last. This year's love, it better last now.
That's David Gray performing his song This Year's Love at Our Piano in the Soundcheck studio. Remember, if you like these performances on Soundcheck, you can follow us on Twitter, at Soundcheck, or like us on Facebook, and we'll let you know all about our latest in-studio sessions. Tomorrow on the show, 20,000 Days on Earth is the name of a new film about the Australian musician Nick Cave. We'll talk with the filmmakers behind this unusual movie. It explores Nick Cave's creative process and his dark sense of humor. Plus, live gospel music in the studio from Naomi Shelton and the Gospel Queens. They'll play songs from their new album, Cold World. That's tomorrow. If you like our theme song, Eagle Rock, find out more about its composer, Marco Benevento, at soundcheck.org. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.